howdy, hey, my dudes, my guys, my boys, my pals. Welcome back once again to Litcast of Doom. As always, I'm your fantastic host, Ronnie Gosh. How's everybody's week going? I hope it's going fantastic. Right now, it's like 60 degrees outside. I'm in tank tops and shorts. I'm getting ready to go out there and throw down a hammock. It's going to be a lit time. We're going to just dive right into this episode here. I do have some housekeeping stuff I'm going to do, but I'm probably going to do that at the end of the episode so I can focus on this book real quick, because let me tell you, I am way too excited to just dive into this with you. So our book this week is The Raven Tower by Anne Leckie. And I know, I'm late. This book came out on my mom's birthday, nonetheless. And I actually got the chance to sit down and finally put all of my attention into reading it when I was flying to and from Seattle. So this book kind of exists in that weird liminal space for me, in that I read it while I was flying, like, on the plane, and I read like maybe 50 pages while I was like in my hotel room, but most of it was done while I was sitting in the middle seat between these two people that kept going, "Hey, what you reading? Hey, what you reading? Hey, what you reading?" And you know, it's just like, please, I'm trying to sit here and have a religious and lucky based experience. Can you just let me read? So at some point I might actually have to go back and reread it just to make sure I know that everything happened, and it's not like my brain is making it up because we were in that weird liminal space of being on an airplane, which does happen sometimes. I'm sure people who like fly more than I do don't get that weird experience, but for me it's just like so bizarre that I have to double check everything to make sure it actually happened, because otherwise it's just some weird plane-based jet lag fever dream, you know? And I think it's really funny on my end that I called this a religious experience, because this book is not the Anne Leckie sci-fi that we've all come to know and love. It's the Anne Leckie fantasy that we've all come to recognize as being just as great as her sci-fi. So it's a different experience, and there's still this pristine and precise execution of everything that, you know, you usually see, you know, in her sci-fi, except it's in fantasy, and it's just like, whoa. And it's not even like the usual fantasy type things. Like, you know, sometimes you'll have this huge overarching fantasy that has all this magic and god worship, and oh, this one's a paladin and they get help from their gods, and I know I'm not using the correct terms. I want to get into D&D, but I can't because I'm awful. So this is just kind of so weirdly, I'm using too many words here. What I'm getting at is this focuses on one of the major pillars of fantasy, and that is the creation of a religious system that has multiple gods, as opposed to just like the one, you know, I don't want to call him the Christian God, because I know other religions also just have one God, and the Christian God is, you know, also the same, you know, Muslim God and the Jewish God, and it's monotheistic, and he's just kind of hanging out up there like absentee dad type thing, whereas these other gods are very human. They can be petty, they can react quickly, they can be angry, but we find that these things aren't always in the best interest of the gods that we get to see. But we'll get into that later. I guess it kind of ties into what I'm going to next, in that what our narrator is actually a god who we find out, you know, at a later point that they've been christened with a name, the Strength and Patience of the Hill, because their main body is this giant rock that's just existed for millennia. And see, here's the thing. When we first start with a book, we know that we're starting with a first-person perspective, because the first word is I. We know that someone is speaking to us and that they're speaking from their point of view, but it's all directed at one person. The narrator has an audience of one person. It's not the reader. And it is the aide to, I don't want to call him a prince because he's not a prince. That's not how this whole system works. But he's the aide to the heir. Well, he's the aide to the heir, and his name is Aeolo. And, you know, our narrator, before we know who they are, is just like, "Hey, Aeolo, I see you. Like, what's up, my guy? Like, hold on, I actually have highlighted one of the parts that just kind of, like, I don't want to say it floored me, but it kind of made me set my book down for a second. I was just like, dang, it's going to get real just from here on out. I know it's going to get real from here on out. And it's right at the beginning of the book, which just, it sets the tone perfectly for the rest of the book. And it's, "Can you hear me, Aeolo? Can you hear me now? I'm talking to you." Like, I'm sorry, every time I hear someone say, I'm talking to you, it's like trying to get their attention and you're kind of getting on the edge of, okay, I'm getting frustrated, but like, buddy, the strength and patience of the hill is long past frustrated, which we find out at the end of the book, was just like, it's just so cool. I'm in love with this story just for what it is, without it even being tied to anybody, just for the fact that it exists, and the way that it exists just kind of like makes me happy. So we'll keep going. We'll keep going. So Aiello is aide to a gentleman named Mawat, who is the heir to the, I don't want to say the throne, but because it's actually a bench. So we could say he's the heir to the bench of the Raven's Lease. So he's the Raven's Lease's heir. Now, this is where it gets a little weird. It took me a second to kind of get to it, get what was going on until, like, it was actually fully explained. And that was kind of just my bad. Once again, I was reading this on a plane. But basically, the town that they live in is under the protection of a god known as the Raven, because that's the body that he usually inhabits and kind of speaks through. And the human that kind of, you know, works with him and acts as his, not like translator, because, you know, the bird can speak okay, but just acts like as his ambassador, I suppose, but just like his human guy, just like his guy, just his guy. That's the Lease. That's what's going on. And so basically what happens is, from the moment that the Raven kind of hatches from an egg as, you know, a raven, like a baby here, the Lease just kind of like takes care of him. He, you know, gives the Raven offerings. He speaks to the Raven. The Raven speaks back to him. Basically, the Raven's Lease is allowed to rule over the city in the name of the Raven. But once that raven has died, like, you know, once it's gone and it's grown and all that stuff, once it has died, the Raven's Lease has to sacrifice himself to the raven. And it's through this human sacrifice that the raven supposedly gets his power. And we find out later, once we hear more from the strength and patience of the hill, that all of these gods get their power from offerings, and that the most power that they can get comes from a willing human sacrifice who willingly gives their life for this god, and that's where their power comes from. And they get power from, you know, smaller offerings like, you know, berries, milk, maybe animals, you know, obviously from, you know, blood of some sort. But the best offerings are human lives that are sacrificed willingly. Like, they just do it on their own. And so that's how we kind of figure out what's going down here with this power. But the reason that we have the story going along is because Mawat's father, who was the Raven's Lease, his raven died. And Mawat's father was supposed to sacrifice himself, and he didn't. And he didn't. Mawat is led to believe that his father has fled his duty, and Mawat comes in to figure out what's going on. He not only finds out that his father is gone, but his uncle, who was not the heir, is now on the bench and is now the new Raven's Lease. And Mawat is mad, just beyond mad, because not only are they telling him that his father is gone, is no longer the Lease, and apparently has just, like, shirked his duty, but someone else has taken his spot, which he has been raised for since birth. And he's just like, you serious, my guy? And so that's where the story kicks off. And as we progress, we find out that his uncle was actually, he's actually the one that killed the physical raven and actually kidnapped Mawat's father, you know, took him into this dungeon type place that apparently only the Raven's Lease can go into. But suddenly everybody's just going in there and they're just like, what? I thought you died if you came down here. And they're just like, guess what? The raven, like the god, the actual physical, like, you know, deity is, like, dying. And the whole reason that, like, we hear from the strength and patience of the hill is because the strength and patience of the hill is in the tower with the raven, and is actually the one that's providing all the power, supposedly, for the raven. And there's this whole big, long story on how, you know, the strength and patience of the hill got there, why the raven is able to tap into their power. It's so fantastic and yet so simple at the same time, because the strength and patience of the hill kind of did this to themselves. But it's good. Just like, the it's a different perspective than what I was expecting and what I was used to, just when it comes to, like, deity-like figures, you know? But it was never anything less than delightful, especially because we see the strength and patience of the hill, you know, interacting with, you know, the people that, you know, would camp underneath them or camp near them, because the people knew that, you know, this rock, they didn't know what it was. They're just like, hey, you know, when we camp here, we're generally okay. There's never any, like, huge disasters. There's never, like, anything, you know, bad that happens and whatnot. The strength and patience of the hill is just like, yeah, I didn't know I was doing that. I'm just kind of hanging here, and I enjoy when they give me things. And, you know, I try, if I don't know exactly what they want me to do, I try not to, like, do anything because I don't want to wreck anything. Because we find out that the whole reason, well, we find out that gods have power and that they can speak into being pretty much anything that's within their power. But what the strength and patience of the hill is worried about is by speaking something into existence that will be more than what their power can handle, or something that will eventually come back and ruin them, you know, in their existence. So he could, you know, they could pretty much say anything could exist. They could say anything could not exist, and they can speak someone's death, and then that person will die. But it does take a large amount of power. Like, there is one point where the strength and patience of the hill is talking to another god known as the Myriad, who just appears as a huge swarm of mosquitoes, which I think is ingenious and also kind of scary. But as they're talking, the group that is camped out near them gets ambushed and completely slaughtered by another group of people. And they come to realize that their senses were kind of muddled up and blocked by another god. And the strength and patience of the hill, while not even, like, getting into, oh, I'm so upset, oh, blah, 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 just, like, the god that did this is dead. And it knocks him out. It takes him, like, almost 2 years to, like, recover. And the Myriad is like, yeah, if I hadn't, like, intervened, you probably would have died. But, like, you know that you done messed up when someone whose name is the strength and patience of the hill, like, who's known just for chilling and just letting life kind of flow around them, when even they're, like, mad enough to just be like, yo, the god that did this is dead. It's like, you know you messed up. And it's like, at that point, I just kind of went, what? Just had to, you know, there were, like, numerous emotional, like, arcs that I, like, went on through this book that I had to go on while in the middle of a plane. And I'm sure I freaked out everyone near me just, like, going through this, just going, like, whispering to myself, oh my god, what did you guys do? What did you done do? It was great. I mean, and that's what they get, being weirded out by that, because they're also just, they kept leaning over my shoulder, like I've told you several times. So it was good, and it filled my heart with this happy little ball of joy, you know? And the only time we ever see this again is right at the end of the book. Like, the last 2 or 3 pages, everything just goes, it goes pear-shaped. That's the best way I could say it without, like, you know, saying a curse word that would require me to put money in the swear jar, because right now I'm currently out of money for the swear jar. But I really, really, really want to read the end to you, and I know other people have read it, and I know we've talked about it, but I don't want to spoil it. But just the fact that, you know, we see at one point what the strength and patience of the hill can accomplish when they're a little upset. And this was when people had designs against the people that they were unconsciously protecting. And then we get to the end of the book, and we see what other gods have done to the strength and patience of the hill. We see what people have done to the strength and patience of the hill. I wish they had a shorter name, just a little bit, to kind of make this a bit easier. And then we see what they plan to do, and it just abruptly stops. And you know that nothing good is going to happen to the people that live in this city. Now, Aeolo makes it out okay. We can talk about Mawat if you really want to. But, you know, the strength and patience of the hill is like, listen, I talked to you, you seem all right, you kind of know what's going down. Everybody else in the city, they're on their own. You can travel safely. I bear no ill will against you. That's, like, what they said. And it's just like, okay, so we know Aeolo's going to make it out. And then the fact that then they're just like, all right, let's go. And then it stops. And it's just like, oh no. And we already know that we're not getting a second book. And Lucky has already said that this is just a standalone type thing. And I can appreciate that, because I don't know how we can raise the stakes from where we are now. I'm sure that, you know, this could turn into a Vicious thing, like what V.E. Schwab did, because we know that Vicious was supposed to just be a standalone book, and then we got Vengeful like 5 years later. So who knows? We might get a sequel, we might not. I'm okay either way, unless Anne Luckey is like ready to blow our minds again, in which case, throw it at me. Now, if I had to pick something to be nitpicky about with this book, really, I can only think of one thing, and that's Aiolo himself. Because, see, here's the thing. I knew from, like, the first, you know, 50 or so pages that Aiolo was transgender, just because they mentioned the fact that, you know, they have bindings on their chest, and that's just, like, trope numero uno for writing transgender characters in a fantasy setting. That's just how it is. But we get to a point where Aiolo is knocked unconscious and wakes up and is informed that someone had undressed him while he was unconscious and found out and knows that he's trans. And it's, I used to be okay with the trope. It's like, okay, sometimes stuff happens, but like as time has moved forward, I realize that it's just a little bit icky, just a little bit like being outed against your will while you're unconscious. Like, I wish we could just kind of take a step forward a bit and be a bit better about that. I mean, Anne might not have known. This is never something that, you know, people really mention out loud because it doesn't happen in popular circles, I suppose. I just feel like maybe we could have just said, whoa, this might be a little icky and maybe done something different. But it does, I don't know. I don't want to say it flows with the narrative because it does and it doesn't. It's just, that happened, that was just kind of like icky, and then read past it, and it's like, okay, we got to get to the better stuff again. And we did. It was just that moment of ickiness. It's like, do we really need that? And what, yeah, whatever. It's fine. I still absolutely adore this book. I love every bit of it, except for that bit. And if you want to discuss it further, we totally can. This is just my sole opinion. Other people might be like, oh, hey, that's totally fine. You know, like I said, it's just my opinion. But this has been The Raven Tower by Anne Luckey. It's out now in hardcover and ebook. Get your little fingers on it because it's too good to put down. Trust me, I didn't put it down like the entire time I was on a plane and pretty much kept trying to go back to it while I was in Seattle. So it's a good time, guys. It's a good time. So, housekeeping. Here's what we got going on. First things first, in case you didn't know, because, you know, it's not like I've been, you know, spreading this around everywhere or not, I do have an official Patreon now. Ba 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 ba! So, you can find it at patreon.com/litcastofdoom. I currently only have a $3 tier, but it's really cool because I send you a letter and then a postcard every month. And who doesn't love getting mail? Because I know I love getting mail, and I promise I'll write something cool in there. It's not going to be like a randomly printed letter. I'm actually going to like write it out with like some fun pens, and I have fun stationery. So it'll be a good time. And you know, here's looking to the future of maybe funding different things I can have made for you guys, like some stickers and buttons, and I thought about pins because pins sound really cool. So we'll see what happens. Shout out to my best guy, Tristan Palmgren, for being my first patron on Patreon. Yeah, getting my words mixed up already. My guy, you are the absolute best, and I appreciate the fact that you decided to throw money at me. Makes my little heart happy. Second thing, I have officially reserved my space to be at Omaha Comic Con. So that's going to be at the end of June. If you're in the Omaha area, right around then, or if you're in the Iowa area, or if you're just coming in, I'm going to have a whole table dedicated just to Litcast of Doom. I promise I'll make something cool to give to you guys, and it'll be a really good time. I'm going to be sitting with a whole bunch of other podcasters. Hopefully, it's not going to be weird or nothing. It'll be cool, I promise. Fingers crossed, I promise, you know? Alright, my last thing. I've been talking about Magic for Liars, like, all the time, because I'm super excited for this book by Sarah Gailey coming out June 4th, which is not my birthday, it's my sister's birthday, but my birthday is the next day, so it all works out. They officially have a really cool pre-order campaign through the publisher. You get this really cool enamel pin, and I want it really, really bad. I already have a pre-order going, so I'm getting my pin. If you guys already have the book pre-ordered, please go ahead and go to the website. I actually have it linked on my Twitter. at Argle Bargles, of course. So you can go ahead and do it and get your cool enamel pin. If you want the pin, you got to pre-order the book, guys. But, you know, you're already going to pre-order it because it's a really good book. Like, trust me. I haven't read it yet. I'm excited to read it. I'm just jazz handsing it over here, you know? Which, you guys can't see me, but my hands are, like, everywhere because I don't know how to talk without talking with my hands. But I'm going to go ahead and cut this episode because we already hit 20 minutes. But you guys take care, have a fantastic day, and peace out.